Standing in his room, Seymour asked himself again if he knew what he was doing. If he went through with this, it would be tantamount to suicide. Was his pride worth losing his life? Was it worth it to keep a woman he met less than 12 hours earlier from thinking badly of him? Despite the obvious answers to those questions, he found himself opening his carpet bag and taking out the wooden case holding the revolver Rebecca gave him. There were bullets in the case as well. With trembling fingers, Seymour opened the gate on the side of the weapon and began thumbing the cartridges into the empty chambers of the cylinder. He loaded it full, then held the gun down at his side. It was heavy. He tried to pull it up quickly, just to see if he could do it. His finger slipped on the walnut grips and he almost dropped it. Perhaps when he fired, he should grip his right fist with his left hand just to steady it, he thought. Then he told himself how ridiculous that was. He would be dead before he ever got to that point. When Seymour returned to the boardwalk, Jack Keller was standing in the middle of the street, as promised. The morning sun cast a dark shadow behind him. The news of the impending gunfight traveled swiftly. The boardwalks were crowded with people out to watch. Seymour saw the avid expressions on their faces and felt a little sick. They were eager to see his blood spilled in the street, eager to see him die.
Well, dude, you came back out. I didn't figure you would. And you really do have a gun.
I told you I did.
Keller lifted his left hand and made a lazy gesture.
Come on, then. Let's get this over with.
Seymour stepped into the street. His legs began to shake so bad he wasn't sure if he could walk all the way out there. He willed his muscles to work and took one step, then two. Pierre Delacroix came hurrying from the direction of the Black Bull. The saloon probably never closed. He caught up to Seymour when Seymour was only a few steps from the boardwalk and gripped his arm.
Are you sure you want to do this, mon ami?
Hey, let him alone, Frenchie. He's a full-grown man. He can make up his own mind when he wants to die.
Monsieur Standish, no one will think less of you if you abandon this mad idea.
Seymour looked over at him.
We both know that's not true, Mr. Delacroix.
But look at yourself. You are shaking so much you can barely hold that pistol. How in the world are you going to shoot it out with an experienced gunman like Keller?
I'll manage somehow.
Or die.
Seymour managed to smile slightly and raise his shoulders in a little shrug.
Get out of the street, Frenchie, or you'll be next.
Delacroix could only shake his head and step back.
God be with you, mon ami.
Seymour resumed his unsteady march toward the center of the street. The gun seemed to weigh more with every step, so that by the time he reached the place where he was going and turned to face Keller, the weapon dragged him to the side. His knees shook, and his mouth was dry, and his pulse hammered in his ears like the pounding of distant drums. Bitterness filled his throat. He worried he would be sick right here in front of everyone who came out to watch the gunfight. Not that he would have to endure the embarrassment for long if it did happen, he reminded himself. Once he was dead, he would be past any shame.
Seymour, you're shaking so hard you look like a little breeze and knock you right over. You sure you want to go through with this? You can still lick my boots instead if you want.
I'm here. Let's get on with it.
Keller laced his fingers together, cracked his knuckles, and stretched. His stance was full of contempt.
Well, if you're sure.
Suddenly, one of his friends called out to him from the boardwalk.
Hey, Jack, wait a minute.
The hell is it, Dugan?
I was just thinking. You can see how scared this fella is.
So?
There's a story about him in the paper this morning. I seen the headline. It says he's the most cowardly man in the West.
Yeah, what about it?
You faced down some hombres who were pretty good with their guns.
Damn right I have. Killed 6 men, every one of them in a fair fight.
What do you think he's gonna do to your rep when folks hear that you gunned down this?
Keller frowned as he considered what his friend said.
You might have a point there, Dugan.
You heard what Cole Halliday said about him yesterday. The likes of him ain't worth wasting a bullet on. It really would be just like shooting a dog.
Keller lifted his left hand and rasped his fingers over his beard stubble jaw.
Yeah, folks might start calling me the man who shot Seymour the Lily Liver. I ain't sure I'd want that.
I know I wouldn't.
Seymour watched and listened to the exchange with a mixture of fear, amazement, and growing anger.
Are you saying that now you don't want to fight me?
Yeah, I reckon that's right. I'm gonna let you live, Seymour.
But...
Get out of here while you got the chance.
You mean you're backing down?
Keller's face hardened again, and for a second, Seymour thought he had just made the worst mistake of his life.
No, you sack of shit! I mean, no self-respecting gunfighter wants to get tarred with the brush of killing the biggest coward in the West. Hell, if I shot you, I'd be a laughing stock from one end of Texas to the other.
Shaking his head, Keller turned away with a dismissive wave. He rejoined his friends and headed for the Black Bull. Seymour was left standing alone in the middle of the street, gun in hand. No one was laughing at him now. No one even paid any attention to him, because he was no longer even worthy of scorn. Seymour didn't think things could possibly get any worse than they were at that moment. He was wrong. As he looked around, the people who gathered to watch him die turned their heads. They didn't want to look at him, didn't want to even acknowledge his existence. Despite that, he felt eyes watching him. As he slowly turned his gaze toward the school at the end of the street, his blood turned cold and sluggish in his veins. Maggie Orion stood there just outside the door of the school, staring at him. She witnessed his shame. She saw the gunman called Keller turn and walk away, totally dismissing Seymour from consideration. At that moment, Seymour wished he could melt into the nothingness. He would have rather died under Keller's gun than have Maggie see what happened. He wasn't sure why that was so important to him, but it was. He turned and stumbled toward the boardwalk, unsure of where he was going or what he was doing, knowing only that he couldn't stay there. Even at this distance, he could feel Maggie's pity. That wasn't what he wanted. He didn't know what he wanted, but that wasn't it. Pierre Delacroix was suddenly there in front of him. The saloon keeper grasped his arm.
Come with me, mon ami. You look like you need a drink.
I told you I don't indulge in spirits.
This is a special occasion. You are still alive.
Only because I'm not worth killing.
The drawing of another breath is always a reason to celebrate.
Delacroix urged him toward the Black Bull, and Seymour was too stunned to put up a fight. He didn't even think about the fact it was still early in the morning.
Are you sure you want a pariah like me in your establishment?
No one will care.
That's the problem. No one cares. Least of all me.
But he allowed Delacroix to lead him into the saloon, and at the Cajun's urging, he tucked the pistol behind his belt rather than carrying it. Delacroix took him to a table in a rear corner of the big room and sat him down. At this hour, not many customers were in the Black Bull. No one was sitting close to the table where Seymour slumped into one of the empty chairs. Delacroix signaled to the bartender. The man brought over a bottle and two glasses. Delacroix sat down across the table from Seymour and poured the drinks. He pushed one of the glasses toward Seymour.
I know it does not seem like it now, but everyone will forget about this in a day or two.
Seymour looked at the glass with a couple of inches of whiskey in it, as if he had never seen such a thing before.
It will do you good.
Moving as if his brain had no control over his muscles, Seymour brought the glass to his lips, tilted his head back, and swallowed all the whiskey in one gulp. No matter how upset and depressed he was, the fiery stuff jolted him as it went down. His throat burst into flame and his belly exploded. His eyes opened so wide they looked like they were about to leap from their sockets. His already pale skin turned the color and texture of thin paper. A second after he swallowed the whiskey, a spasm racked him, making him lean forward over the table. His fingers scrabbled feebly against the wood. Surely not even being shot out there on the street would have hurt this much. Seymour rested his head on the table.
Ah!
You'll become accustomed to it, mon ami. And you will find you have no finer friend in this world.
Seymour doubted that. After a few moments, though, the inferno inside him subsided, leaving behind a warmth somehow comforting, even on a summer morning as the West Texas heat was building to a simmer. Seymour lifted his head. He blinked a few times and then forced out words.
It's not so bad.
As I told you, sip this one instead of taking it all at once.
Seymour did like the saloon keeper said, sipping the whiskey instead of bolting it down. The warmth in his belly grew without setting him on fire again. He drew strength from it. Delacroix hadn't taken his own drink yet, but Seymour didn't care about that. He didn't particularly want company either, but he couldn't very well ask Delacroix to leave. The Black Bull belonged to him, after all. Seymour sat there in sullen silence, sipping the whiskey. He lost track of time. All he knew was that after a while, Delacroix got up to do something else, leaving the bottle on the table. Whenever Seymour's glass was empty, he reached out and snagged the bottle by the neck. His hand shook a little, so the bottle rattled against the glass as he poured, but overall, he thought he was steadier now than earlier. He trembled so bad in the street, it was a wonder he'd been able to stand up. A man approached. Seymour raised his gaze from the table. The man came to a stop a few feet from the table and stared at him. Seymour blinked eyes grown bleary from drink and looked back at him. The man was stocky, with a dark, squarish face. He wore a black-and-white cowhide vest and a flat-crowned black hat. The butt of a gun with checkered grips stuck out from the holster on his hip.
"You're him, Seymour the Lily-Livered."
Seymour made no response. There was nothing to say.
"You know who I am?"
Seymour managed to shake his head. The motion made the saloon seem to tilt first one way and then the other.
"I'm Ned Aiken. I'm fast with a gun and I've killed 4 men. Folks around here think I'm a pretty bad hombre."
What was it about him that drew these gunfighters to him like bears to honey? Did he give off some sort of scent to men prone to bullying and brutalizing those weaker than them?
"They say you're the most cowardly man in the West. I reckon I got to see that to believe it. On your feet, dude. I see you got a gun. But you won't use it, will you? You're too lily-livered for that."
Seymour looked past Aiken and saw Pierre Delacroix standing at the bar with a worried expression on his face. The Cajun didn't want this confrontation happening inside his saloon, but he wasn't going to interfere either, Seymour sensed. Probably because Ned Aiken was every bit as dangerous as he claimed to be.
"Well, how about it, Seymour? You gonna show me just how cowardly you are? Are you gonna just sit there staring at me like some sort of half-wit?"
"Go ahead and shoot me. Get it over with."
"You want me to kill you? You ain't gonna beg for your life?"
Seymour put his hands on the table.
"I'm not afraid of you."
Standish pushed himself to his feet, and to his enormous surprise, he realized he meant it. Nothing Aiken could do to him would be any worse than the things he already endured. Nothing could be worse than making a fool of himself in front of Maggie Orion.
"Damn you, dude, I could kill you right now."
"You wouldn't dare. Then you'd be known as the man who wasted a bullet on Seymour the Lily-Livered."
All the whiskey Seymour had guzzled down since coming into the Black Bull splattered all over Ned Aiken's boots.
"Son of a bitch!"
His hand stabbed toward his gun, but he stopped the motion before he drew the revolver. His hand was clenched around the gun butt, but after a second, he let go of the weapon.
"Ugh, you're right, you scrawny little bastard. Killing you would just hurt my rep."
Seymour half sat, half fell into his chair again. Having thrown up all the whiskey, he wanted another drink. He reached for the bottle. Delacroix stopped him with a hand on his wrist.
Perhaps you have had enough, Seymour.
Seymour shook off the Cajun's hand.
Others, when I've had enough.
He didn't bother with the glass this time, just lifted the bottle and drank straight from the neck. The whiskey didn't burn near as much going down now. With his free hand, Seymour dug around in his pocket until he found a coin.
"I can pay for my own drinks."
Delacroix looked at him for a moment, then shrugged and swept the coin from the table.
"As you wish, mon ami."
"And stop calling me your friend. I'm not your friend. I have no friends."
"That is as you wish, too."
Delacroix motioned for the swamper to come over and mop up the whiskey Seymour vomited. Luckily, the sawdust scattered thickly on the planks soaked up some of the mess. The whiskey in the bottle gurgled as Seymour took another drink. It was a nice sound, he thought. He asked himself why he wasted so many years disapproving of drinking. It was the last coherent thought he had for a while. He woke up with the sound of piano music in his ears. The tinny strains were accompanied by a considerable amount of loud talking and laughter. Tobacco smoke tickled his nose. Seymour lifted his head and shook it to try to get rid of the annoyances. That was a mistake. His head thudded against the table. He left it there for what seemed like an hour until all the crazy spinning stopped. When he finally pushed himself upright again and opened his eyes, he was more careful about it. The Black Bull was crowded now, with most of the spaces at the bar filled and poker games going on at several of the tables. Seymour glanced toward the big front windows. One of them was boarded up, and he recalled the drunken cowboy's bullet nearly hitting Miss Maggie Orion the day before. Through the other window, he saw the fading golden light of dusk. He was passed out in the saloon all day. His mouth tasted awful, and he was parched. A drink of cool water sounded better than anything in the world, but the thought of it made his stomach clench. He hadn't eaten anything in almost 24 hours. He needed food and drink, but not whiskey. A shudder went through him at the very idea. He had to get out of here. His mind reeled at the thought he allowed himself to get thoroughly inebriated. That wasn't like him at all. He flattened his hands on the table and tried to push himself to his feet. That made the world lurch to a halt around him and then immediately begin revolving in the wrong direction. As Seymour's brain spun, he would have fallen if not for the hand that suddenly grasped his arm.
Let me help you, Seymour.
Seymour recoiled and tried to pull away from the saloon keeper.
You've helped me quite enough. You were the one who got me drunk in the first place.
No one put a gun to your head and made you drink, Seymour. I provided the whiskey, that's all.
Seymour wanted to argue with the Cajun, but it just wasn't worth the effort.
Let me out of here. I want to go.
Go where?
That simple question stopped Seymour in his tracks. Sweet Apple wasn't his home. He had no place here except a dingy hotel room. But that was better than the saloon. He shook off Delacroix's hand and stumbled toward the bat wings. Seymour wanted to lash out at the saloon patrons who laughed at him. He didn't, of course. He didn't do things like that. He was too civilized and respectable to get in a shouting match with a bunch of half-drunk louts in a frontier saloon. He almost fell again when he reached the bat wings. He caught hold of them, swung them aside, and lurched out onto the boardwalk. He didn't think he was still drunk, but he was so unsteady on his feet he had to consider the possibility he might be. He wondered if a pot of strong black coffee would help. That thought made his stomach lurch too. But he didn't throw up, and by focusing his will on what he was doing, he was able to walk down the street toward the hotel in a fairly straightforward fashion. He might have weaved a little, but he didn't think it was too bad. When he reached the hotel, he fumbled for a second with the doorknob before he was able to get it open. The same clerk was behind the desk. Seymour blinked owlishly at him.
Don't you ever get a break?
The man ignored the question.
You've got some visitors, Mr. Standish.
Seymour had no idea who in Sweet Apple would want to be visiting him. He was a laughingstock, after all, someone to be pointed out and mocked. But then he saw several men standing up from chairs on the other side of the lobby and come toward him.
Mr. Standish, we've been waiting to talk to you.
The man was portly and well-dressed, with mutton-chop whiskers and a waxed mustache. The men with him were all similar, with a well-fed, successful air about them. Seymour realized, with a shock, he recognized one of them. J. Emerson Heathcote, the newspaper editor and publisher who did so much to spread that humiliating nickname, Seymour the Lily-Livered, all over town.
Oh, you!
Heathcote raised his hands, palms out.
Now, I don't blame you for being upset with me, Seymour, but you have to admit it made for a very good story.
You made me look like a cowardly idiot.
Silver linings, my boy, silver linings.
Seymour stared at him in confusion for a second.
What are you talking about?
The first man who spoke replied.
You're already famous, Mr. Standish. Mr. Heathcote put copies of today's paper on the trains bound for San Antonio and El Paso. He has associates in both places who will pick up the story and run it.
Heathcote nodded, beaming in satisfaction.
You mean everyone in Texas is going to read about the most cowardly man in the West?
Yes, and if the story is picked up by the Eastern papers, it won't be long until the entire country knows about you, my boy. Harper's might even send a reporter out here to get the full story.
My God. My God.
That meant Uncle Cornelius would find out what an abject failure he was. Strangely enough, the thought didn't bother him as much as he expected it to. He was a lot more worried the increased notoriety would make him fall even lower in the eyes of Maggie Orion, if that was possible.
I'm the mayor of Sweet Apple, Abner Mitchell. You already know J. Emerson here, of course, and these gentlemen are the other members of Sweet Apple's town council. You're going to put us on the map, Mr. Standish.
Oh, all because you were visited by a craven coward like me?
No, sir, because you're the man who's going to tame the hell-roaringest town in the West.
Abner Mitchell reached inside his coat, then held out his hand toward Seymour. The lamplight in the hotel lobby gleamed on the star-shaped badge in his palm.
You see, Mr. Standish, we're here to ask you to accept the job of Marshal of Sweet Apple.
Seymour could not have been more surprised if the man asked him to flap his arms and fly to the moon. He was so shocked that for a long moment all he could do was stand there with his mouth open, unable to say anything.
Marshal? You want me to be your marshal?
The members of Sweet Apple's town council all nodded.
That's right. Isn't it a wonderful idea? I thought of it, you know.
You're insane!
The newspaperman blinked and looked a little surprised, not to mention crestfallen. Mayor Mitchell insisted.
Not at all, Mr. Standish. We think you're the perfect candidate for the job.
Seymour wondered if this conversation was real or just a figment of his whiskey-addled imagination. He decided it was real, but unfathomable.
Why in the world would you think that? Everyone else who pinned on a lawman's badge in your town has been killed, gunned down ruthlessly.
Seymour looked at Heathcote.
Isn't that what you told me?
Yes, but you're different, Seymour.
How am I different? Except that I'm even less of a threat to the lawless element than those other men were.
But you see, that's what makes you perfect.
When Seymour just stared at him in incomprehension, the mayor went on.
Cole Halliday, Jack Keller, and Ned Aiken, three of the most notorious gunfighters and killers west of the Pecos, have already confronted you, and yet you're still alive.
Because they all said I'm not worth killing.
Be that as it may, you're still alive. You faced down those gunmen and survived to tell the tale.
That part of the story will spread rapidly, too.
I still don't understand.
No self-respecting gunfighter wants to be known as the man who shot Seymour the Lily-Livered. If someone did kill you, that moniker would follow him for the rest of his days. He would become the object of ridicule, not you.
Of course I wouldn't be the object of ridicule anymore. I'd be dead!
Heathcote didn't pay any attention to that.
Yeah, well, there might as well be a bulletproof wall around you, Seymour. Your lack of bravery actually makes you the safest man in the West.
Based on the evidence of everything that happened since his arrival in Sweet Apple, Seymour had to concede Heathcote might be right about that. But he still didn't see how that would make him an effective lawman.
No one's going to pay any attention to what I say if they're not afraid of me. I can't keep order.
No. Well, if not for you, there would have been at least one more killing in Sweet Apple. If any other dude had come into town and bumped into Cole Halliday, Cole would have shot him dead, no doubt about it. And we can't forget Miss Orion, either.
What about her?
He didn't want Maggie dragged into this ridiculous farce.
Chances are she would have been killed yesterday afternoon if you hadn't acted when you did. Your quick action really did save her life, Seymour.
For a second, Seymour stared at him and thought about that. Heathcote was right, he realized with a shock. Knocking Maggie out of the way of that bullet was an instinctive reaction. Even so, he saved her.
So you see, you've been of service to the community already, Mr. Standish. If Miss Orion had died, Lord knows if we ever would have found another teacher. And a town has to have a school if it's going to grow and prosper.
Seymour couldn't argue with that. But these men forgot about one important thing.
I'm a dry goods salesman. I have no experience or training as a law officer. I wouldn't have any idea what to do.
Just keep the peace. Arrest anyone who gets too obstreperous. They'll cooperate with you. They'll probably think it's all a grand joke being arrested by Seymour the Lily-livered.
Seymour winced. He hated that name.
I came to Sweet Apple to sell dry goods.
We thought of that. It just so happens I own the largest general mercantile store between Del Rio and El Paso. Mr. Manning and Mr. Lesser here also own emporiums in Sweet Apple. We're all prepared to open accounts with Standish Dry Goods and purchase a considerable amount of merchandise from your company, Seymour. If I may call you Seymour...
He nodded as he tried to take in the offer. Being able to deliver three big new accounts might elevate a standing in his uncle's eyes.
And with that leg up, so to speak, you'd be free to devote more of your time to your duties as marshal.
Seymour wished his head wasn't pounding so loudly. The after effects of his drunken binge were brutal. He found it difficult to think clearly. The idea of him as a lawman was crazy, of course, absolutely insane. But these men seemed determined he'd take the job. And they believed his reputation for cowardice would keep him safe and even make him a more effective law officer. On the face of it, the idea made no sense at all. Yet Seymour knew in real life things that seemed to have no chance of working out sometimes did. If they didn't, then phrases such as "against all odds" and "the exception that proves the rule" never would have been coined. Lightning had to strike somewhere. Why not in Sweet Apple, Texas? And there was one more consideration looming larger and larger in Seymour's mind. Right now, despite the gratitude she probably felt toward him, Mackie Orion had to hold him in contempt. She knew he had been humiliated again and again. She heard the chants of Seymour the Lily-livered, and no doubt read the horrible headline and story in J. Emerson Heathcote's Sweet Apple Gazette. No matter what he did now, he told himself, chances were he could only go up in Maggie's estimation.
All right.
He reached out with a shaky hand to take the badge from Mayor Mitchell.
I'll do it.
He pinned the tin star to his coat, although it took him 2 tries to do it.
Huzzah!
Heathcote was probably thinking what a fine story it would make for the Gazette when the foolish new marshal was murdered, Seymour thought. The 3 merchants insisted he fetch a sample case so they could conclude their business arrangements. Seymour was still hungry and thirsty, but he knew a salesman must take his opportunities where and when he found them. A deal postponed was often a deal lost. He got his samples. Within 30 minutes, he wrote 3 sizable orders to send back to Uncle Cornelius in Trenton. The other members of the town council, with the exception of Heathcote and Mitchell, left the hotel. Now the newspaperman took Seymour's arm.
I'll show you the marshal's office. We do have one here in Sweet Apple, you know. It's just unoccupied at the moment.
But no longer. It won't take long for people to hear Sweet Apple has a marshal again.
In fact, the word already spread through the settlement, Seymour judged from the way people looked at him, and the buzz of conversation got louder as he, Heathcote, and Mitchell walked down the street. The citizens seemed to know what was going on. In fact, some of them started trailing along behind the 3 men, as if they wanted to see what was going to happen. They came to a small adobe building with a padlocked door. There were hooks in the wooden awning over the boardwalk where a sign of some sort once hung, but they were empty. Mitchell took a key from his pocket and used it to unfasten the padlock. He swung the door back, reached inside, and picked up something that was leaning against the wall. It was the sign for the hooks, Seymour realized. Painted on it was the legend, "Marshall, Sweet Apple, Texas." The words were still readable, despite the fact 6 or more bullet holes riddled the sign.
Some of our rowdier citizens had a tendency to take pot shots at the sign, especially when they were drunk. That's why we put it away.
And we didn't have a marshal anymore anyway. Now we do.
Heathcote and Mitchell each took one end of the sign and raised up on their toes to hang it from the hooks. It swung back and forth a little as they let go of it. Seymour gazed up at the sign and thought he ought to feel a little pride at the sight of it. He was the marshal now, after all. Instead, he just felt a little dizzy and confused and disoriented, as if he were trapped in a dream world where things were happening that had no business happening. Once inside, Heathcote lit a lamp on a desk with a scarred top. The desk, like everything else in the room, was covered with a fine layer of dust. Seymour turned to a rack on the wall holding several rifles and shotguns. He brushed his fingers over the smooth, polished stock of a Winchester, leaving marks in the dust coating the wood.
We tried to provide the marshal with the tools he needed to do the job. You'll find plenty of guns and ammunition here. There's a file drawer in the desk for reward posters and other important papers, a couple of cells in the back where you can lock up prisoners, and there's also a little room with a cot where you can sleep if you want to.
We'll have some wood for the stove brought in.
Heathcote looked Seymour up and down with a critical eye.
Also, you'll need more suitable clothes and a hat. Yes, I know you don't have a hat.
Seymour flushed at the memory of how Cole Halliday shredded his hat with bullets.
Don't worry about any of that. Anything you need, my store can supply, and the town will pay for it. I'll bring over some clothes and a hat. Do you have a gun belt and holster for that pistol?
Seymour shook his head.
I'll get that for you, too. And some coffee, a pot, and a few other supplies. How about a saddle?
I don't have one. I don't have a horse.
Well, Frank Thomas down at the livery stable can provide a mount any time you need one. The same goes for a saddle.
What else do you need?
Something to eat, and perhaps some cool buttermilk.
Seymour hoped that would settle his stomach.
Oh, sit down, sit down. I'll have Agnes from the cafe bring a tray over right away.
I could go over there to eat.
Heathcote and Mitchell both shook their heads.
It's taken us a long time to get someone back in this office. You just sit down. Stay right here. We'll be back.
Well, all right.
Seymour lowered himself into the swivel chair behind the desk. It was covered with worn leather upholstery, but more comfortable than it looked. The other two men hurried out, leaving him there alone. They were showing a lot of faith in him, Seymour thought, with a wry smile as he took the gun from behind his belt and placed it on top of the desk. He felt a strong urge to run as far and as fast as he could while they were gone, leaving that marshal's badge behind for them to find when they got back. Instead, he looked down at the badge pinned to his coat and stayed where he was. He was trying to remember the last time anyone actually had faith in him. A few minutes later, a middle-aged woman with graying blonde hair and bright blue eyes came bustling in with a cloth-covered tray in her hands.
You'd be the new marshal? I'm Agnes Swenson from the cafe. Mayor Mitchell asked me to bring some supper over to you.
Yes, ma'am.
Seymour politely rose to his feet.
I appreciate it. How much do I owe you?
Agnes Swenson set the tray on the desk.
Oh, not a blessed thing, Marshal. The town pays for all your meals while you're wearing that badge.
Well, I'm much obliged.
Agnes whisked the cloth off the platter of food. Seymour saw fried chicken, mashed potatoes covered with gravy, greens, and a large biscuit. The tray also had a glass of buttermilk on it, cool enough for condensation to form on the outside of the glass. At the sight and smell of the food, Seymour's stomach rebelled for a second, then settled down. Under the watchful, approving eyes of Agnes Swenson, he sat down and began to eat. With every bite, he felt a little better. He washed the food down with swallows of the buttermilk.
You know, you don't really look like a coward. You just look like a nice young man.
Seymour wasn't sure whether to feel insulted or amused. He settled for amused.
You'd better hope I am the most cowardly man in the West, as Mr. Heathcote dubbed me. The town council seems to be counting on it.
Well, all I know is you should be careful. Being the marshal is a mighty dangerous job in this town. I should know. They talked my husband Axel into pinning on that badge a while back.
Seymour laid down his knife and fork and frowned. According to everything he'd been told, the previous Marshal of Sweetapple died in short order. That meant...
I'm sorry, Mrs. Swenson.
Agnes used a corner of her apron to dab a tear away.
Just you take care of yourself, Marshal Standish. Don't try to stand up to those bullies and killers. It's enough the town has somebody to call the Marshal again. You don't have to actually do anything.
Was that what they really wanted? Just a figurehead so the community leaders could claim they brought law and order to Sweetapple, whether that was the case or not? Maybe he was supposed to just sit here in the office and ignore his duties so Mitchell and Heathcote and the other politicians could put on a big show and pretend to care about the citizens, all the while allowing the forces of lawlessness to run roughshod over them. A hollow feeling grew inside Seymour's chest as he realized that might be exactly what they wanted. Well, if ineffectual was what they wanted, he could deliver that, he told himself. He'd been doing it all his life, after all. Mitchell and Heathcote returned with everything they promised. Seymour went into the back room and emerged a few minutes later, dressed in black whipcord trousers, a white shirt, and a black leather vest. He wore high-topped boots and a black hat that seemed ridiculously large. Around his hips, he buckled a gun belt and holster of hand-tooled leather. He slipped the pistol into the holster and found it fit fairly well.
Don't forget your badge, Marshal.
Seymour pinned it to the vest.
How do I look?
Like an actual lawman.
Except for the, spectacles.
Well, they'll have to stay, otherwise I can't see well enough to do my job. Shouldn't I go and make my evening rounds or something? Isn't that what a marshal does?
Oh, don't worry about that tonight. There'll be time enough to start that later.
You're sure?
Yes, of course. Just stay here in the office tonight. Let the people get used to the idea of having a marshal again.
It seemed to Seymour the citizens of Sweetapple would get used to the idea quicker if he were out among them. But Mitchell and Heathcote were both adamant he didn't have to make rounds tonight. It would be all right with them, he thought, if he didn't make rounds ever. They left. To have something to do, he opened the file drawer and started looking through the wanted posters jumbled inside. A half an hour or so into it, the door suddenly opened. He looked up, feeling a surge of alarm. But instead of some gunfighter coming to shoot him, he saw Maggie Orion. Perhaps she was no less dangerous, though.
Seymour Standish, have you lost your mind?
Miss Orion, what are you doing here?
Maggie straightened and crossed her arms over her bosom as she glared at him.
I heard people talking about it, but I didn't believe it. I had to come see for myself. Now I almost wish I hadn't.
Come to see what?
Seymour forced himself to ask, though he was afraid he already knew the answer.
The biggest fool north of the Rio Grande. Seymour. May I call you Seymour?
He nodded foolishly.
Seymour, have you lost your mind? Why in heaven's name would you want to take the job of Marshal and Sweetapple? You're going to get yourself killed!
Finally, he was able to shake his head.
Mayor Mitchell and Mr. Heathcote and the other members of the town council assure me that won't happen.
J. Emerson Heathcote is a pompous windbag, and the mayor and the other councilmen aren't much better. How could they promise you that? How could you believe them?
Seymour leaned forward, getting over his surprise at her visit and warming to his subject.
It makes perfect sense, Maggie. I can call you Maggie?
She jerked her head in a nod. Somewhat surprised at his own daring, Seymour went on.
I've encountered three of the most notorious gunmen in the area, Cole Halliday, Jack Keller, and Ned Agin, and lived to tell the tale. Despite everything, none of them were willing to kill me. To do so would be bad for their reputations.
You're willing to stake your life on the fact that three men didn't want to waste a bullet on you?
Exactly. I'm untouchable for that very reason.
How do you know that all the gunmen in the area are going to feel that way? What if you come up against one of them who's too drunk to worry about what will happen to his reputation if he shoots you?
Well, I think the mayor and the council intend for me to avoid such confrontations as much as possible.
But it's the marshal's job to deal with trouble.
Maggie stopped short as understanding dawned on her pretty face.
Oh, my God. They want you to just sit in the office and pretend to be a lawman.
I wouldn't have put it quite so bluntly.
though the thought did cross his mind in almost the same words Maggie used.
That way, the next time there's an election, they can all say they brought law and order back to Sweet Apple, even though in reality nothing has changed. Seymour, they're risking your life for their own political gain.
I don't see it that way.
Even though, again, he had the same thought.
I'm getting something out of it too, you know.
What, Marshall's wages? That can't be much.
I wrote up 3 new accounts today for Standish Dry Goods. Mayor Mitchell, Mr. Lesser, and Mr. Manning are all going to purchase merchandise from the company my uncle and I own.
So it's just a business deal to you. You don't really care if you help the people of this town or not.
You just said you didn't want me to.
I don't want you to get yourself killed, that's all. You saved my life, Seymour. I'm grateful to you. I don't want to see you get hurt. But the whole arrangement seems so unfair to the town. I don't know what I want.
Seymour pushed his chair back and stood up.
You think I was wrong to take the job?
Yes, of course.
Because I might get hurt and because I'm not capable of doing it properly?
Well, look at you. You're no gunman. You're not a fighter of any sort. I doubt you could subdue a child, let alone a full-grown, angry, drunken man.
Seymour felt his face growing warm as he recalled the 2 youngsters who tormented him so when he first arrived in Sweet Apple. Maggie was probably right. Those boys were unafraid of him for a good reason. He was no threat, even to the likes of them. True or not, her words went through his wounded pride like a knife. He picked up his hat from the desk and slipped it on.
Seymour, what are you doing?
I need to make my evening rounds. The mayor and Mr. Heathcote told me it would be all right to skip them tonight, but I have a feeling they'll say the same thing tomorrow and every other day as long as I wear this badge.
Seymour, don't go out there. A marshal's badge is a big target, especially in this town. Some of the men may not be able to resist taking a shot at it, no matter what you think.
A thin smile curved his lips.
Well then, we should be able to find out in a hurry what sort of lawman I'm going to be, shouldn't we?
This isn't what the council wanted.
Perhaps not. But I've always tried to conduct myself in an honorable fashion. Right now, that means doing the job I'm being paid to do.
But you're not being paid to enforce the law. You're being paid to pretend to.
He swung around toward her.
To pretend to be a real marshal? That's what you were going to say, isn't it? Well, a real marshal may not be what the council thought they were hiring, but that's what they're getting.
He wasn't sure where the bold words came from. The idea of going out there into the streets of this wild settlement with a gun on his hip and a badge on his chest made him tremble inside. But his knees were surprisingly steady. Maybe a person could actually grow accustomed to the idea of looking death in the eye. Seymour didn't know. But if he was going to be the Marshal of Sweet Apple, he was going to have to find out. He opened the door and stepped out onto the boardwalk.
Seymour!
Steeling himself not to look back, Seymour walked out into the street. Full darkness had fallen, but fires burned here and there inside barrels and lights from the buildings slanted through their windows. The street was bright enough so Seymour could see several men on horseback and a couple of wagons rolling along. The riders reined in to stare at him as he strode across the street. He told himself he would have to get some spurs so they could go ka-chink, ka-chink when he walked. He headed toward the Black Bull, which was as loud and rowdy as it always was at this time of night. That would be as good a place as any to start his rounds. When he pushed open the bat wings a moment later, tobacco smoke, laughter, and the smell of stale beer washed over him. No one in the place noticed him at first, but as he stood there with the badge shining on his vest, more and more people looked in his direction. From his position at the end of the bar, Pierre Delacroix stared.
Seymour? Mon ami? I heard, but I did not believe.
Please, go along with what you were doing, folks. I'm your new marshal, and I'm just making my rounds.
J. Emerson Heathcote stood up from a table in the back of the room. Seymour noted it was the same table he himself spent most of the day, passed out drunk. Heathcote's face was redder than usual, indicating he was putting away some whiskey himself.
Seymour! Why, you weren't supposed to be...
Seymour knew he'd been about to say, you weren't supposed to act like a real marshal. Seymour smiled grimly.
I know you and the mayor told me I could assume my duties tomorrow, Mr. Heathcote,
but I didn't see any reason not to get started tonight.
Yes. Well, yes, of course. That's fine. Just fine.
Everything's under control here, Seymour. I mean, Marshall. Your presence is not needed at the moment.
All right. If there's any trouble, send someone to find me.
Delacroix nodded, but he didn't look like he really meant it. It would take time, Seymour thought, but the people of Sweetapple would come to realize he intended to carry out the duties of town marshal as they should be performed. They would realize that, if he lived long enough. He gave everyone in the room a slow, deliberate look, then nodded as if to agree everything was under control. He backed through the bat wings and onto the boardwalk. His heart was pounding like a locomotive. Fear fluttered in his belly like a caged bird, but he thought he succeeded in keeping that emotion concealed while he was in the saloon. As he turned away from the Black Bull, he felt beads of cold sweat on his face. The breeze, still hot from the scorching day just past, quickly dried them. Seymour made his way along the street, stopping in at the businesses that were still open to introduce himself and have a few words with the owners. The reactions he got were consistently shocked. Everyone heard about him becoming the marshal, but no one seemed to have really believed it until they saw with their own eyes the badge pinned to his vest. He rattled the doorknobs of the businesses already closed to make sure they were securely locked. He was aware people were watching him. He could feel their eyes on him. The sensation made his skin crawl, but he tried to ignore the feeling. But ignoring his instincts might not be a good idea, he realized, as he walked past the mouth of an alley and somebody called softly from the shadows.
Hey, Marshall!
As Seymour stopped and turned toward the voice about to say, yes, warning bells went off in his head. Just because the gunmen who frequented Sweetapple didn't kill him in open combat because of damage to their reputations, it didn't mean some of them might not bushwhack him. He was dead and no one knew who did the killing, no problem. The thought flashed through his mind in the second it took him to stop and turn. Somehow he kept turning, twisting aside and throwing himself to the ground. An earth-shaking roar assaulted his ears. Twin geysers of orange flame lit the alley. Seymour landed hard enough to make him breathless. He gasped as he slapped at the holster and found it empty. The revolver Rebecca gave him slipped out as he threw himself down. He pawed at the dirt in the alley mouth, searching for it. He couldn't hear anything except the ringing in his ears from the terrible blast. The vague realization someone hidden in the shadows fired both barrels of a shotgun at him seeped into his brain. He touched the ivory grips of the revolver, scooped it up, and wrapped both hands around it. His right thumb found the hammer and drew it back. He held the gun as tight as he could and pressed the trigger. He cocked the pistol and fired it a second time, then a third, squeezing off the shots awkwardly, but with a semblance of speed. Then he rolled to his left, lurched to his feet, and dived onto the boardwalk. He scrambled over next to the front wall of the building and put his back against it. No one came around the corner from the alley. Seymour kept the gun pointed in that direction as his hearing gradually came back. He became aware of shouting in the distance. It came closer as he pushed himself to his feet, still keeping the revolver trained on the mouth of the alley where the bushwhacker lurked.
Seymour! Seymour, for God's sakes, are you all right?
He recognized Heathcote's voice. Turning his head a little, Seymour saw the newspaperman approaching at a run, followed by several other men.
Stay back! Someone took a shot at me from that alley!
Were you hit?
I don't think so.
Seymour shook all over, unable to control the reaction any longer. He clamped his hands harder on the gun and tried to steady it, without much success. But the danger seemed to be over. There were no more shots from the alley. He doubted if anyone would try again to kill him with a growing crowd nearby. Quite a few people joined the group, including Pierre Delacroix, several of the town councilmen, even Maggie O'Ryan. Seymour's heart leaped when he saw her. Her face was pale, and her lips were pressed together tightly with either worry or disapproval or both. But he saw relief in her eyes, too. Relief he was all right. He felt better, despite his fear.
One of the horses tied her at the hitch rails, got a few buckshot wounds in his rump. The bushwhacker missed the marshal, but got his poor horse.
Somebody lit a lantern and handed it to Heathcote, who shone the light down the alley.
Nobody there now. Well, you must have run him off, Seymour. I mean, Marshall, but look there.
The tone of surprise in Heathcote's voice made Seymour look where he was pointing. Seymour didn't see anything in the lantern light except some sort of dark, wet splash in the dirt of the alley.
Oh, dear Lord. Is that blood?
It certainly is. You winged the son of a bitch, Seymour!
So he actually wounded the bushwhacker with at least one of those blind shots, Seymour thought. It seemed impossible. He was no gunman. He hadn't even tried to aim, but rather fired in the general direction of the alley as fast as he could. One of the bullets from his gun found its target, ripping through flesh and shedding blood. There was the proof, right there on the ground, spilled from the veins of the man who tried to kill him. Odd how the blood was such a dark red in the lantern light that it seemed almost black. The blood? Seymour's eyes rolled up in their sockets. Deuce Mallory always kept an eye on his back trail. Once it became obvious no posse was coming after them, the outlaws slowed down as they headed for the Rio Grande. Mallory was eager to carry out the raid on Sweet Apple, then cross the border into Mexico, where he planned to enjoy a long vacation from robbing and killing. At the same time, there was no reason to get into a rush. Those poor bastards back in Buckskin were probably still licking their wounds from the Mallory gang's attack. Along the way, they stopped at a few isolated ranches, killing the settlers and taking anything of use. At one place in the mountains, they ran into a cantankerous old-timer who amused Mallory so much, he decided to let the geezer live. They settled for burning down his barn instead of killing him. The men were getting a little antsy, though, Mallory sensed. They were ready for action, ready for another big raid. They had too much violence and brutality inside them. They had to get it out from time to time, or turn on each other. As the leader, Mallory had to gauge things to decide when it was time to strike. It was coming soon. For now, though, he was content for the gang to remain another day or two at this camp in a wooded canyon southwest of the Davis Mountains, about halfway between Fort Davis and the Rio Grande. They had been there for a day already, letting their horses rest after the long ride from the Texas Panhandle. Mallory listened to the men laughing and talking and caught the undercurrent of tension in their voices. They were without women, they were low on booze, they were edgy. That was the way he wanted them. Let the steam build up a little more. Then, when they hit Sweet Apple, they wouldn't even think about holding back. He was playing a desultory small-stakes three-handed game of poker with Steve Larrabee and Gus Brody when Carl Henderson approached. Mallory figured Henderson wanted to be dealt into the game, but saw a worried look on his face.
What's wrong, Carl?
The lookout spotted somebody coming, Deuce. Just one man, but he's hunched over in the saddle like something's wrong with him.
Mallory gave orders a couple of men were to be posted at both ends of the canyon at all times. The last thing he wanted was for the gang to get penned up in here. He was sitting cross-legged on the ground beside the blanket where the cards and money were scattered. Like a snake, Mallory uncoiled from that position. Instinctively, his hand moved closer to the gun on his hip.
Which end of the canyon?
South.
Mallory motioned to Larrabee and Brody.
Come on, let's see what this is about.
The four men strode toward the south end of the canyon. Henderson pointed to one of the lookouts.
You can see him from up here, Deuce.
Mallory climbed to the top of the leaning rock slab where the man was posted with a rifle and a pair of field glasses. He didn't need the glasses to see the approaching rider, who was now about 300 yards from the mouth of the canyon. As Henderson said, the man was slumped forward in the saddle and appeared to be holding on tightly to the horn to keep from falling. Mallory observed enough badly wounded men in his lifetime, many of whom he shot himself, to recognize what he was seeing now.
Anybody else out there?
He asked the sentry as he swept his eyes over the brown, semi-desert landscape stretching from the canyon on down to the Rio Grande. He didn't see any signs of movement, but he wanted the estimation confirmed. The man shook his head. The rider kept coming straight for the canyon. Mallory watched him for a moment more.
It's not a trick. I'm gonna see who that is.
With that, he slid down the rock slab to its base, landing lightly on his booted feet, and strode out from the jumbled boulders at the canyon mouth toward the rider. Larrabee, Brody, and Henderson exchanged worried glances, then hurried after their leader. Mallory thought there was something familiar about the man on horseback. As he came closer, he was sure of it. The man's face was gray and lined with pain under a brown Stetson. He wore a buckskin jacket and denim trousers. The jacket hung open. Mallory caught a glimpse of a dark stain on the gray woolen shirt underneath. The horse shied as Mallory approached. The rider roused from his semi-stupor. He raised his head and looked directly at Mallory, who felt a shock of recognition.
Nick? Nick Carlisle?
Edward?
He had to be one of the few men left alive in the world who called Mallory by his given name.
I was hoping I'd find you.
Then he swayed and was about to fall out of the saddle when Mallory sprang forward to reach up and steady him.
Give me a hand here. He's an old friend.
Several of the other outlaws ran to help. They lowered Carlisle from the horse's back and carried him up the canyon to their camp. Carlisle was lowered carefully onto a thick pallet made of blankets. Mallory dropped to a knee beside him and pulled back the jacket and blood-stained shirt to reveal an ugly black bullet hole in Carlisle's torso. A check of the man's back revealed no exit wound. The slug was still inside him.
Ugh.
Carlisle coughed and blood flecked his lips and chin.
I knew you were on your way to Sweet Apple. I hoped I would run into you.
Larrabee hunkered on the other side of the wounded man.
Who is this hombre, boss? How's he know about our plans?
Mallory felt a surge of anger at Larrabee's questioning.
I already told you he's an old friend. Nick Carlisle and I were in college together back east before the bastards who ran the place kicked me out. He knows where we're headed because we keep in touch.
That was true. Through an elaborate set of blind addresses designed to keep their connection a secret since neither man wanted it revealed, Mallory and Carlisle exchanged letters every few months.
Nick's in the army. Don't take that the wrong way. He's as enterprising as any of us and has been for as long as I've known him, isn't that right, Nick?
Guns. Shipment of repeating rifles.
Mallory's grin disappeared. He leaned closer to the dying man.
Tell me about it, Nick.
Going from San Antonio to El Paso. Train stops for water in Sweet Apple.
A shipment of army rifles. That's what he's talking about.
That'd be worth a fortune.
Shut up. Let the man talk.
Partner of mine, Major Trevor, set it up with some Mexicans, revolutionaries. Diego Alcazario. Steal the rifles. But Alcazario double-crossed him. Killed him. I saw what happened. Damn greasers. Can't let him get away with it.
Did they shoot you too, Nick?
Carlisle managed a weak shake of his head.
I decided to ride up here, see if I could find you, Edward. But I ran into some Apaches. I had to fight my way loose from them. Brought a bullet with me.
Yeah, I noticed that. You're dying, Nick.
Yeah, I know.
You want me and my boys to steal those rifles so this Diego Alcazario doesn't get them? Is that right?
Figure he'll hit the train when it stopped at Sweet Apple. I won't be expecting you to hit him.
That's right. We'll take the bastards by surprise. But when will the train be at Sweet Apple, Nick? I have to know when the train will get there.
In my pocket. Train schedule. Details about the shipment. You can make a big cleanup, Edward. Just kill Alcazario for me.
Sure, Nick. Sure.
He lifted one side of the wounded man's jacket and reached inside to search for the papers Carlisle mentioned. He found them in an inside pocket, a little blood-stained around the edges, but legible. A quick scan of them told Mallory everything he needed to know. The train carrying the shipment of army rifles in one of its baggage cars wasn't due to arrive in Sweet Apple for another week. He delayed this long, Mallory thought. For the sort of payoff he could get for 500 brand-new repeating rifles, he could wait another week to strike, and the rest of the outlaws would be willing to do that too once they heard what was at stake. Plus, there was the matter of avenging the double-cross Diego Alcazario pulled on Carlyle and his partner, a Major Trevor. Nick promised for years to use his military connections to let Mallory in on something big. It was the main reason Mallory stayed in touch with the man and kept him up to date on his plans, just for something like this. Now, the stars finally lined up right, except Carlyle wasn't going to be alive to enjoy the fruits of his efforts, of course. But that didn't matter all that much to Mallory. Sentiment only went so far. He was willing to carry out Carlyle's wish for revenge on the treacherous Mexicans, but in the end, the man's death really meant one less share of the profits to give up.
Don't worry, Nick. We'll get those guns.
Mallory noticed Carlyle's eyes were glassy. His old friend was dead.
What the hell's going on here, Deuce?
I'll explain everything, Steve, but the short answer is that we're going to wait a little longer before we hit Sweet Apple. When we do, though, it's going to make us even richer than we thought.
Rebecca Jimerson carried the telegram into Cornelia Standish's private office and laid it on his desk. The message was in a sealed envelope, as Standish instructed. He didn't want anyone except Rebecca to get wind of his plans for Seymour. She was the only one he trusted, and he didn't have complete confidence in her. He glared at the yellow envelope.
Is that from Texas?
I don't know. It was sealed when the messenger brought it.
Standish picked up the envelope and tore it open with eager fingers. Rebecca knew what he hoped to find in there. The news his nephew Seymour was dead in Sweet Apple. But as Standish read the message, an angry frown appeared on his face.
Damn it!
Something wrong?
You always were a perceptive little bitch.
Rebecca kept a tight lid on her own anger. One of these days he would regret how he treated her, she told herself. Even as the thought went through her head, she knew how unlikely it was. She liked the comforts and luxuries money provided too much to ever risk losing her position. Besides, she was afraid of Cornelia Standish, probably with good reason.
I know you hired private detectives to keep an eye on Seymour. Is that wire from one of them?
Yes. He's in San Antonio. He says Seymour has become something of a celebrity in a very short time. Some newspaper man dubbed him the most cowardly man in the West.
Rebecca's smile had a touch of sadness to it. The description certainly suited poor Seymour.
But here's the worst thing. Those idiots in Sweet Apple made him the town marshal.
The town marshal? Seymour?
That's right. It's ludicrous. It's insane.
Of course it is, but I don't understand why you're upset about that. You wanted Seymour to run into trouble, didn't you?
I wanted one of those Western gunmen to blow holes in him. But according to the detective in San Antonio, the Texas newspapers say he's been successful in facing down several gunfighters. He saved a woman's life and even fought off an ambusher. What the hell is wrong with those Texans? They can't even kill one quivering little mouse of a man like Seymour. Ah, I should have known if I wanted something done about this problem, I'd have to take more direct action myself. You simply can't rely on anyone to do what they're supposed to do these days.
Rebecca found herself wondering if the woman Seymour saved was young and pretty. Not that it mattered to her, of course. She had her moment of pity and weakness when she took the gun to him before he left Trenton. Since then, she hardened herself to the possibility she would never see Seymour Standish again. That was just the way things must be. But from what Seymour's uncle was saying, not only was Seymour surviving in Texas, he was thriving, flourishing even. Was it possible a man lived under that meek exterior after all? The question was more intriguing to Rebecca than she would have expected it to be.
Send for Wilford Grant. I want to see him.
Rebecca frowned. She didn't like Wilford Grant. Standish hired him on a couple of occasions in the past, when some of the employees of Standish Dry Goods, Inc. started talking about forming a union. A few broken legs and busted heads persuaded the employees to abandon the foolish notion. Wilford Grant and a few of his equally brutal friends provided the incentive. Rebecca knew Grant could usually be found in the bar of the Metropole Hotel, several blocks away.
I'll find a boy to take a message to him.
Right away.
Rebecca sent for Grant and went back to her desk, to her work. But a feeling of worry nagged her. She could hardly believe the things Standish told her about Seymour. She wished she could see them for herself, with her own eyes.